You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. When you need energy on the go and don't have time to wait in line, grab Espresso Monster. Espresso Monster is a premium blend of espresso and cream made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend complete with taurine and B vitamins. Each can has 3 shots of espresso and comes in vanilla espresso and espresso and cream flavors. I had one this morning before I came into the studio, and let me tell you, it gave me just the boost I needed to get my day going. Plus, it tastes so delicious, I'd drink it anyway. So close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Laurel and Hardy are widely regarded as the greatest comedy partnership in movie history. Between 1927 and 1950, they made over 107 film appearances, defining the notion of the double act with infectious chemistry and hilarious routines that seemed effortless but were honed down to the finest detail. Then, in 1953, diminished by age, and with their golden era as the kings of Hollywood comedy now behind them, Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy made a final effort to recapture the old magic with a variety hall tour of Britain. The charm and beauty of their performances shined through, and the tour became a hit, just as long-buried ghosts and Oliver's failing health began to threaten their precious partnership. Now, Academy Award-nominated actors Steve Coogan and John C. Reilly portray this most tender and poignant of creative marriages during their swan song in a new film called Stan and Ollie. And today, John and Steve join me on the podcast to talk about stepping into the shoes of this legendary comedy duo and how some remarkable special effects makeup and more than a little bit of padding helped John C. Reilly step into the famously large pants of Oliver Hardy. Steve and John share memories of watching the classic short films of Laurel and Hardy when they were kids, how the director of Stan and Ollie's emergency appendectomy gave them an opportunity to make a pilgrimage to the Stan Laurel Museum in England, and how they went about recreating the pair's famous comedy routines. They discuss what goes into a 35-year partnership like Laurel and Hardy's, what it must have been like for the two stars to have no identity separate of each other, and why Stan and Ollie's on-screen friendship didn't become a real friendship until the very end. Plus, John C. Reilly talks about being part of another famous comedy duo. We debate the pros and cons of the old Hollywood studio system and the controversy over Oliver Hardy's most famous line. Coming up with John C. Reilly and Steve Coogan in just a moment. Today I'm sitting down with Oscar nominees Steve Coogan and John C. Reilly, who star as the classic comedy duo Laurel and Hardy in Stan and Ollie, which opens in theaters December 28th. Guys, thanks for sitting down with me.
Pleasure.
My pleasure.
First, just for anyone who doesn't really know Laurel and Hardy in this day and age, Laurel was the skinny one and Oliver Hardy was the fat one, right?
Right.
Okay. Which is not an aspersion on John here.
I have to interrupt there and tell you that John wore a giant fat suit, so he's not in that league.
Yeah, Oliver Hardy was a lot more than the fat guy, and Stan was a lot more than the skinny guy. They actually contributed so much joy to the world.
Yeah.
That it's a really special thing to be able to bring them back to life and remind people of their work, not so much our work, but use our work to remind people of their work and get people to look at their films again.
Yeah, and I absolutely loved this movie, not just because as a kid I grew up watching the old Hal Roach shorts, but there's also just something about a pair of entertainers in their swan song years. It always reminds me of Chaplin and Keaton and Limelight or movies like The Sunshine Boys. What do you think there is that's just so irresistible about the archetype of a comedy duo a little bit past their prime and who may have hung around a little longer than they should have, maybe?
I think I'd say the appeal of comedy duo, especially Laurel Hardy, is it's about friendship. So instead of a sole comic performer who can be a kind of fool at odds with the world, Stan and Ollie were at odds with the world, but they were at odds with the world together. Mm-hmm. And that's an important part of the appeal, is that and why people gravitated towards them, is because underpinning all the comedy that they did, and did very skillfully and with great craft, was a kind of love for each other that, despite their differences and the scrapes and misfortunes that they get up to, that you didn't doubt that they were their best buddies, you know, and that as John said on numerous occasions, you know, Oliver may be impatient with Stan, but he never leaves him.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you mentioned Limelight. That is a great example of a behind the scenes kind of movie about comedians, but there aren't that many. And I think one of the reasons that this film has an appeal for audiences, even if you don't know who Laurel and Hardy are, is because people love going backstage. I think that's what reality TV is all about, getting behind the scenes, behind the artifice. And there's a fascination with that, and for good reason, because it's a very interesting life. It's a life that Steve and I have both had. So
yeah,
it's something that we share with Stan and Ollie, this life spent with sore knees and sweaty brows and makeup rooms behind the stage talking about ticket sales. Like, that's stuff that Steve and I have lived. So I think, and the fact that these two in particular, Stan and Ollie, were a miraculous pairing. And by miraculous, I mean they were plucked out of obscurity and thrown together without knowing each other, without having an act. Mm-hmm. And they became one of the most beautiful partnerships in the history of the human race, I think.
I can't think of many other examples.
I
mean, some things have occurred to me since I've been talking about this movie a lot. And one of the things that having John and I have both having experienced working in comedy, I think it kind of it sets us up, although it's a daunting task, I think we had enough tools in our toolboxes to be able to go about it, you know, with some tenacity. But one thing I've learned about the comedy of Stan and Ollie doing this movie is how healing comedy can be, and how unifying it can be. And we take it for granted. We don't really stand back from comedy and look at it or analyze it much, because by its nature, it's there just to be enjoyed. But there's very few other kind of art form that can unite people of different political views, different religions, different world views in a moment when something's funny and everyone laughs at the same time. And that's incredibly powerful, and something that I think something we need more of in this day and age when there's so much acrimony around, and something that should be saluted. You know.
Now, did you guys come to this as fans of Laurel and Hardy already? Did you grow up on these shorts and the features?
Yeah, it's funny. People have been asking us a lot, you know, when's the first time you became aware of Laurel and Hardy? And my answer is, I've been aware of Laurel and Hardy as long as I've been aware. You know, they have this eternal quality, and not only because of their act, they have this eternal quality of being fat and skinny, salt and pepper, yin yang, Stan and Ollie. They have that kind of presence as if they've always been here and always will be. Mm-hmm. But in my own life, from my earliest memories of watching TV, they were there. They were always been a part of my life.
Yeah, the same as John. You know, the reruns on TV and everything. Yeah. But
even in the UK, they were.
Oh yeah, sure. Well, during summer vacation in the UK, they would every morning they would repeat the same group of shows, and a lot of them were U.S. imports. Like we'd have Casey Jones, the Banana Splits, and then Stan and Ollie in the middle of it, and some European imports dubbed, you know. But there'd be a whole bunch of shows that were shown repeated every day, and that's so it became, you know, it became intimate with mm-hmm. with all their films, yeah.
And it must have been intimidating to step into these guys' shoes, but particularly when you're playing a famous, iconic comedy duo like Laurel and Hardy, who were together for 35 years and, as we've already said, had a deep love for each other. Going into the project, were either of you nervous that you might not have the chemistry to pull it off?
That's a loaded question, isn't it? But I think well, for my mind, when John agreed, I knew John was more cautious than me. I mean, I was cautious, but my vanity outweighed my caution, because I thought, what a gift to be able to do this, and John was had more trepidation. But I for me, the only thing that for me, the green light for me to do it would be when John signed up.
Mm-hmm. Chemistry is a funny thing, you know. We talk about chemistry as if it's this mysterious thing that falls upon people like a gentle rain. Only some people. I met her and we had chemistry, and I knew we were bound to be married. And so there's this tendency to feel like you either have chemistry or you don't. In my experience, having done 4 duo movies this year, including this one, is that you can create chemistry, but you have to, first of all, you have to be working with someone who's not a jerk, which luckily enough, Steve isn't.
Thanks for saying that.
Hopefully he feels the same way.
It needs to be pointed out sometimes.
I'll answer in my own time.
But what happens is that if you collaborate with someone, you stand shoulder to shoulder with them, sort of have a foxhole-like experience with them, which is what it was like, being shot out of a cannon into this incredibly intimidating prospect of playing these two legends. What eventually happens is you fail in front of each other a bunch of times, and the guy likes you anyway. Yeah. And then you develop trust, and you're vulnerable in front of each other, and then presto changeo, you have chemistry. And that really is, I think, the process as we went through the rehearsals of the characters. That is how we found the chemistry.
Yeah, I guess it's that, you know, we needed each other, just like Stan and Ollie did, to pull this off. And when we rehearsed, we were kind of rehearsing the dances and the sketches, which had 4 weeks rehearsal before the movie started. That was not only a chance for us to bond and get to know each other, it gave us a chance to sort of step into the shoes of Stan and Ollie, because they would have had to rehearse those routines just like we did.
A lot of times there aren't rehearsals in a movie, but because you were doing choreographed dances and that sort of thing,
and also
routine,
yeah,
famous,
and also, also
routines,
yeah, also to, anecdotally, yeah, absolutely, yeah. But anecdotally, there was also the director was had appendicitis and had to delay the shoot by a week, so John and I were kind of twiddling our thumbs, and I said, why don't you come up to the north of England, where I have a place, and it's close to the Laurel and Hardy Museum. And I said, let's go on a little pilgrimage, you know, in the hometown where Stan Laurel grew up. So,
oh, that's right, because he was an Englishman.
That's right. Yeah. And so it was that also was a kind of a bonus in not only in just having to approach the roles, but in some ways, if we were playing arch enemies, then we wouldn't need to develop chemistry. But we had to do this. They had to be friends. We inevitably are playing two characters that rely on each other and help each other, and that's literally what happened to us.
Yeah. Now, John, you've been part of an ongoing comedy team of sorts. I think, what have you done, about 5 movies with Will Ferrell, including Holmes and Watson that's coming up next year. Do you think you could have ever done 107 movies with Will without wanting to kill each other?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it is what sets Laurel and Hardy apart from their peers and for everyone else, for that matter, in the history of the world. They were performers that only worked together from the beginning of their careers until the end, with one notable exception that we talk about in the film. But that is a special strain on the relationship, to have not only your professional identity, you know, grafted to someone else, but your personal identity. Like when people would see these guys in the street alone, they would say, Where's the other one? Where's the other one? Yeah. Like, people couldn't accept the fact that they weren't together all the time. And even I, like, that was one of the shocking things to learn about while doing the research for the film, was that they weren't, like, very chummy socially when they're in their heyday in the 1930s. They were very different people, and they'd go off in their different ways. And it wasn't until they did these theatrical tours that they really became close personally, and where they saw the other human being as opposed to the other side of the act.
Yeah, yeah, it's a very interesting way that their friendship developed, kind of in reverse, because back in the day when they were making the movies, Oliver wanted. I was thinking about it before, and I think Oliver worked to live, and Stan lived to work.
Interesting.
And that meant that one of them was a perfectionist, and was, I would imagine, slightly less happy than in his life overall than Ollie, who took time to smell the coffee. In the latter years when they toured, they were living in each other's pockets, and I think they discovered that at the end of the year, at the end of their days, that all the people in the professional and personal life had come and gone, and the only constant was the guy opposite them. And I think they recognized that in the autumn of the
That was a real stroke of genius by our writer Jeff Pope to set this story, rather than try to tell a stock biopic kind of story, that we focused on this one kind of elegiac period of their life right at the end of Oliver's life. I think that was a really great way for us to have some artistic license in terms of what they might be saying to each other, but also an important period of their life where you could kind of learn everything you need to know about these two guys by focusing on that chapter of their lives.
Yeah, in some ways it seems like this is the period when their real life friendship catches up to their on-screen friendship that people have always just assumed was there.
Yeah, their work was that powerful. Like, it would be like when I was a kid, I never even thought of them as independent entities. I would think they would go home together, and they would sleep in their bed together, and they would cook breakfast together, and then they'd come and tell this story. Like, it's hard even now to separate them in your mind.
I want to talk about the division of labor between Stan and Ollie. Steve, is it fair to say that Stan Laurel was the creative force behind the team?
They were brought together by Hal Roach, the film studio
who also producer. Did the R Gang comedies, the
That's
Little
right.
Rascals, and so
and,
on.
And he was the architect to bring them together. But beyond that, the chief creative was Stan Laurel, and he kind of took authorship of the whole thing, really. That's not to diminish Ollie's role, because when they were on set, Ollie would work and take care with things and talk about it, make suggestions and all the rest of it. But once he clocked off, and I think Stan did.
It's almost like Stan was writing for an audience of one. And if Oliver said, "Yeah, that'll be funny," boom, that's the bit we'll use. But it was, and it seems like a small, insignificant step in that long process after him doing all this writing and work. But it was a very important one for them. That last sounding board moment when Stan would say, "What about this?" And Oliver's reaction would set what was going to work for both of them.
Yeah, that's one of the most fun parts of this is to see you bouncing ideas off of Ollie and how you're kind of just, like you said, doing it for an audience of one. And one thing that I kind of come away with in this is these guys just love to entertain. It didn't matter whether it was a theater of thousands or a hotel desk clerk or each other. They were the type of personalities like, say, a Mel Brooks, who just walks in and lights up a room and can't help himself. In the movie, it seems like they were the kind of people who just, wherever they were always on.
Oh, that's what I was going to say. I was going to say that when they did entertain people if they bumped into someone, they would do a little routine. And they did do this when they were together, when they were on tour, especially if someone saw them, they would do a little bit of a routine for them. I think it was slightly different with them, because I felt they did that because they felt they had had an obligation to, like a responsibility to, but an ethical responsibility to be the people that the people wanted them to be.
I also think you have to keep in context the time at which they were their most popular in their heyday, when audiences responded to them, it was during the Great Depression in America. It was a very, very difficult time for people. Mm. So, and they were not great stars that were brought together to make a super team. They were struggling. They both went to Hollywood to just try to make a living.
Yeah.
And so I think they never lost that understanding and that humility that comes with, it could have been me on that breadline.
Yeah.
And so when they saw the joy that they were giving to people in desperate straits, that it really resonated for them in a different way that than, you know, people like us had grown up in a very comfortable, you know, situation. I think those kind of hard knocks really teach you humility, and it teaches you that everyone should be treated with dignity and kindness if you can. You know,
there's a definite kindness and warm-heartedness to Stan Ollie. That doesn't mean it's lowbrow, or doesn't mean that it's not smart, because it is smart. It's smart comedy, and they're quite subtle and nuanced in a lot of their performances, just in between the slapstick. But the warmth of the comedy is something I think that you forget, because it was, again, not only was the Depression, the rise of fascism in Europe at the time. It was pre-Second World War, remember. And people, there was an appetite for this loving comedy, because...
I just thought of a good example of how their comedy could have been dumb, but was in fact intelligent. So there's this whole thing, the cliche is fatty fall down, you know, like... A fat guy falls down, ha ha ha. But what was funny about it when Oliver did it was not the fall down part, was afterwards, the annoyance with my place in life.
Yes.
You know, and that's another deeper than just fatty fall down, you know?
Yeah.
Even though
they
were trafficking in that kind of broad stuff, they would always add this layer of, I don't know, like... existential crisis or something.
Yeah, well, looking into the lens was a very bold thing to do at the time for Ollie, which I think was, happened by accident, didn't it? Did it happen by accident?
Oh, really?
Well, they were shooting something, and I think
Stan would deliberately say, he'd say, like, we're going to have you done by 4, don't worry, Ollie, and then 4:15, 4:20, 4:30, and then he would do these things where he needed a certain reaction when Oliver was, like, dying to get out of there to go to the golf course.
But I think the first look down the lens was like an accident thing where he just said, oh, that's great, do that again, when he was genuinely, you know, impatient.
He was tired of doing it.
There's a documentary where someone said that. Yeah, it was like, it was just, and the tie twiddling thing, that was an accidental thing he was doing, because I think he didn't know what to do in the middle of a scene or something, and he said, do that tie, Stan said, do that thing with your tie again. Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with John C. Reilly and Steve Coogan when we come back in just a moment. Use your sports and pop culture knowledge to make some extra cash this week with BetDSI. BetDSI.com has been paying winners for 20 years. With a really user-friendly interface and mobile site and the fastest payouts in the industry, it's no wonder BetDSI is top-rated on betting review sites. Simply play, win, and get paid. BetDSI offers betting options for everything from NFL, NCAA football, NBA, NHL, UFC, and all other major sports, to politics, reality TV, esports, virtually everything. There's also live betting, which lets you bet on games through the entire matchup, every play and every minute until the end. Try for yourself. New members get 100% bonus match using promo code KICK. That's more than double your money to start winning today. Just go to BetDSI.com and use promo code KICK to get this limited-time 100% bonus offer and make some extra cash on the sports you know and love. It's only a game until you bet it at BetDSI. And now, back to the podcast.
There was a love there that maybe was lacking in similar comedies of the era. When I think back to like the Marx Brothers, which I love the Marx Brothers, there is a lack of the kind of cynicism and the sarcasm that you see in like a Marx Brothers or even Abbott and Costello.
Sure, there's a kind of there's an edgy kind of aggression to a lot of that stuff. And which, as I say, sometimes gets confused with being more sophisticated. That to be cynical is sophisticated, and to be poignant or have a gentleness means that you're the reverse.
So those are two very different examples you give. Abbott and Costello, to me, represent a kind of exceptionalist American thinking post-war, where it was like hyper-verbal, really cynical, hard-edged. One guy's dumb, the other guy's smart, and you're meant to believe that guy really is smart and that guy really is dumb. The Marx Brothers, their identity was born out of being Jewish Americans, looking at what the world did to Jewish people, and coming from a ghettoized kind of performing background of the Jewish theater and all that. So there's a world weariness to the Marx Brothers routines that's specific to their experience.
That's
different than Laurel and Hardy. Laurel and Hardy almost seemed beyond their time. They seem to be
they're kind of Shakespearean.
Talking about issues of the human race, not issues of their time.
That's right. Yeah.
And now you can't work together for 35 years without having some hurt feelings and some resentment. What do you think was at the crux of the tension between Stan and Ollie?
Well, we hypothesized in the film that it was a great, fissure in the relationship when Oliver went off and did the one film he did without Stan once their career began. Actually, they both worked in film previous to working together. But the truth is I've been in a lot of artistic partnerships and so has Steve. And what happens is in order to protect the act, you overlook the personal. So if someone's late in the morning, it's driving you crazy. You could tell them, hey, man, you were late. But then you know if you do that, there's going to be tension. And the thing we have to do on stage tonight
I was never late, by the way.
You were never late. But I'm just making an example of a little thing that might annoy you that you overlook to benefit the act.
Yeah.
And what happens, even just the smallest things, even if it wasn't such a big betrayal as working with someone else, just the small little things that start to drive you crazy, if you bury enough of them in order to keep the act going, eventually it rears its head in this ugly way. They all band together, these small hurts, and become these dragon conversations,
I've worked in lots of bunker-like comedy writing rooms, and you laugh a lot, and sometimes you row as well. And the rows are always as a result of the hothouse intense experience of working very hard and trying to make something really good. It's almost inevitable. Fortunately, John and I managed to avoid that. I think we kind of say it. We skimmed close to each other maybe a couple of times, but I don't think I don't think we came to blows.
Well, we weren't looking at 30 years together.
That's true.
We got to get through three months,
and we're done.
One thing that I found really amazing is that apparently, even after Oliver Hardy retired, Stan kept writing scripts for Laurel and Hardy. It's hard to know what to make of that. I mean, depending on how you look at it. It's either a form of therapy or a form of delusion. Do you think that he looked on Ollie as his muse?
I think it comes down to that line that my character says in the movie, which is, what else are we going to do? What else are we going to do? This is what the guy spent his life doing. He didn't write for anyone else. He wrote for he and Ollie. So if he loved writing, that's what he wrote about.
I think it's probably a little bit of the two. But if something helps you, clearly he knew that they weren't going to. He wasn't going to find another. He wasn't doing it because he was hoping to discover another Ollie. He was doing it because that's what he'd always done. And some of us are lucky enough to do something that even if we didn't get paid for it, as long as we could make a living, pay the bills. We do it anyway, and do it unpaid. Don't tell.
Movie business requires a lot of cooperation of other people with money, and when you don't have that cooperation, and when you're an actor, it can be really tough to do what you want to do for a living if you're not being asked to do it by a movie company. So I bet in some way it was some way for Stan to continue working in the movies, even though movies weren't knocking on the door anymore.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, and in the movie, we see some of your battles with Hal Roach, the producer who did most of the Laurel and Hardy movies. As working actors, are you glad that you kind of weren't around during the golden age of Hollywood? I mean, it seems romantic, but actors were basically one step above being indentured servants in the studio system.
I mean, yes. I mean, the thing is, you would get... They were paid, by reckoning, if anyone's reckoning at the time, a very good salary. Mm-hmm. Compared with any ordinary job, but it was not, but it wasn't going to pay for their retirement, right. And they, you know, Hal Roach was a hard-headed businessman. That's to be kind, and you know, he played them off against each other and knew what their insecurities were, and divided and conquered in terms of the deal they got, and so that's, you know, that's. Yeah, that's the way that
I often think, because I'm you know, people call me a character actor all the time. And my dad was obsessed with character actors. He taught me who all the great character actors were of the 1940s, anyway. And so I often think of trying to put myself in that situation. Like you asked us, how would you fare in the studio system? And in some ways, yes, we're workaday actors. We're treated like cattle, you know. Mm-hmm. But if you made a few good pictures, like, you could become a well-known movie star. And in that case, so one of the big things that we have to deal with as modern actors is generating the next job, finding mm-hmm. it, looking for it, generating, finding yeah. it, looking for it. But if you were on a studio contract and you were in a hit movie, you're going to be working as long as those movies kept hitting, you know, like, so that's one part of it that you wouldn't have to worry about. So, yeah. you know, I did this animated movie at Disney. And that, in a way, was like having a studio job, having to go to the same place and report for duty. And I actually found it really comforting mm-hmm. and nice to have the support of a place, you know, knowing I'm going to be working for this place for 3 years or whatever it is. You don't have the terror of, like, what's going to happen mm-hmm. when this all ends. But maybe I'm painting a rosier picture of it than
I mean, well, some people did get, you know, I mean... they did have security. That's what Ollie liked about it. In actual fact, he didn't want to break out on his own, really. He liked the security right. of having a salary and knowing where the next paycheck was going to come from.
Right, right. And money, I guess, never came easy, or at least they weren't good at hanging on to money. Particularly Ollie, I guess, was a gambler. And it reminds me of years ago, I guess...
Well, the alimony didn't help.
Well, yeah.
Either
yeah.
of them.
Yeah, what, three or four yeah. marriages? Yeah. Yeah, and it reminds me, I guess, probably like 20 years ago, I lived next to what used to be Stan Laurel's house. And in my mind, I thought, oh, old school movie star. He must have some Pick Fair-like place in Beverly Hills. And here it was. It was like this extremely modest, pretty small little ranch house in Sherman Oaks. That
was his big place, by the way. Yeah. He ended up in an apartment in Santa Monica.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I've heard from other entertainers who they would call him up because he didn't have an unlisted number. He was so cheap that he wouldn't have his number unlisted.
That's
so
right.
Like Dick Cavett and all these kids would call up Stan Laurel, and he would talk to them on the phone when they were these little five-year-old kids and so forth.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess if nothing else, this movie is a cautionary tale for an actor about why you need to have a business manager.
Yeah, I think Stan was very happy to talk to people on the phone when they called. I've heard some of the conversations because some people recorded them.
Right, right.
With the tape recorder from their end of the call. And so,
at the time that those phone calls were coming in, they weren't so legendary. You know what I mean? They were kind of forgotten. So I bet they felt kind of happy that people were still cared enough to reach out.
Yeah, it's funny because they weren't, people forget, people think that, when they see these a lot of these even iconic movies, there was a fallow period after, you know, after they had their life at the cinema. Mm-hmm. That I thought that was it. There was not going to be any other medium to exploit it. So, you know,
once you were out of the theaters, then you're out of the theaters. Yeah. That's it. There was no other.
In those days, TV was as unforeseeable a kind of media as the internet was 30 years ago.
Sure.
You know, people just couldn't see
right.
it.
And it wasn't really, I guess, till the 60s when they started having revivals in movie theaters and reruns on television.
Plenty of things were appreciated in a different way. There's a kind of a craft that people would, I mean, like I remember reading It's a Wonderful Life, that was kind of a forgotten movie at the time. It came, had its life in the cinema, and it went away. Right. And it was only in the 1960s on TV that the love for it grew. Mm-hmm. And the same, I think, is true of Stan and Ollie, is that when something's out at the time, you don't analyze it too much. But then years later, you think, why is this stuff still funny? And people sort of appreciate it not just in a disposable way. Mm-hmm. They don't just laugh and forget about it. They laugh and they go, these guys are great.
But you're right, they could have used a better agent. They really could. They could have used someone advocating on their behalf purely from a business point of view, mm-hmm. because that is the reason that they were in these dire straits that we present in our film. Mm-hmm. It was right. because they weren't given any back end. They weren't given any television royalties. Yeah. They had no source of income once those salaries dried up. But you know, when you really look at them and how much they cared about their work and how much time they spent crafting this partnership, I don't think they really cared all that much about money mm-hmm. until it was too late.
Yeah, oh, that's really? Very true. Wow. That's very true, huh. yeah.
Now, you recreate some of their famous bits. Some of them are actually incorporated into the film in ways that sort of reference the scene from The Music Box, the famous scene where they're pushing the piano up the stairs, and then some are more direct. They're either on stage or at one point you recreate their dance that they do in, I forget which movie it was, Way Out West.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Way Out West, which became sort of their hallmark. Laurel and Hardy weren't exactly Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly, so did you have to recreate the mistakes as well when you did that?
Well, it's funny that dance is almost like it's a joke about not being Fred Astaire right. and Ginger Rogers.
Yeah.
It's literally a dance a child could do at first, anyway. Yeah. It starts from a toe tap. To another toe tap,
yeah.
To its shuffle, you know, like, and so it builds in this way. It's actually really not surprising that it became the hallmark performance of their careers because, in a way, it's a distillation of what they did so perfectly in so many other ways. It is an escalation of a simple idea,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether it's destroying a car in a tit for tat battle or whether it's, you know, failing to get a piano up a set of stairs. It would start in this very simple, innocent way and build into catastrophe yeah. or into something so complicated it's absurd. So, that dance, we definitely had to... that's the one thing in the film that we tried to do forensically. Like, mm-hmm. we're going to do this, if we can, right. as much as we can, we're going to do it exactly yeah. like right. they did it, down to the little right. shambling mistakes. You know, there's a looseness to that mm-hmm. dance. It's not mm-hmm. just... It's yeah. not like a perfectly executed
yeah.
dance.
Yeah, that was quite tough, because then we had to learn the correct version of the version of the dance without the mistakes for when we did it in the live shows.
Right.
So
because right. the other one was recreating a famous film.
It was,
scene
that's
so
right.
People
yeah,
would
yeah.
notice.
Exactly. Yeah. So we had to
we also had to add a layer of physical disability to that dance the second mm-hmm. time we do it,
yeah.
you know?
Because
we're the same people. Yeah. We yeah. could have done the dance just the same yeah. way, but I had to keep reminding myself, no, you can't, you can no longer jump like or without hurting your knees really bad. Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. Now, that scene is part of this extended scene that the film opens with. It's an incredible 6-minute tracking shot that follows you guys from the dressing room through this famous Hollywood studio lot and onto the set, right into an argument with Hal Roach. That looked like a really tough scene to shoot from an actor's perspective, or from anyone's perspective, I guess, but... one mistake, you've got to go and reshoot all over again. How many takes did you guys have to do?
Well,
I think we did about 28 takes of
one section.
It's actually three pieces stitched together.
Those were the 28, wasn't there? And there was 18 in the studio, I think I remember. There's mm-hmm. 28 was in the one
the walking
when
one.
They walked through the back lot.
Yeah,
we did 28 takes of that.
Wow.
And before we got one, I think that worked.
I actually love it when you have to, you know, film is so stop and start.
Yeah.
You get so used to or sort of conditioned to directors saying, oh, no, stop, do this. Or that was a mistake, just go again. And you never get like a long run out of something.
Mm-hmm.
So when we do these long walking and talking shots in movies, I love it because it reminds me of doing theater, you know. It's like, so long, director. I'm on my own for the next 7 minutes or
yeah,
whatever it
yeah,
is.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of enjoyable. But the toughest thing is that, you know, if you make a mistake, you've got to reset all these hundreds of extras and they're all going to go back to their marks. And it's pretty scary in that regard. But I remember having to convince myself, because we're supposed to be having this relaxed intimate conversation, very casual conversation. And of course, that's completely at odds with the thought that if you make a mistake, everything's going
right.
to be crippled. But I remember sort of thinking at the time, I have to act like this doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if I make a mistake. And counterintuitively, that means you don't make a mistake.
No. I mean, but as people, when you're walking through that studio lot scene, you want to go, whoa, look at that. Look at those showgirls. Look at the Roman. Holy cow, look at that. And you can't, because this was just mundane to them. It was as if they're walking through the factory floor, you know?
Yeah.
And another aspect of the film that was technically impressive is the makeup in this movie is really incredible. I don't think that I've ever seen prosthetics that were more believable and natural in a movie. Particularly with you, John, you're playing, I think, someone who was like a 400-pound man, and it doesn't look like Eddie Murphy in The Nutty Professor. It looks very authentic. What did all that entail, and how hot was it in that suit?
Well, I think Eddie Murphy in The Nutty Professor was deliberately going over the top, mm-hmm. and you weren't. That wasn't supposed to be some cinema verite film, but... we had one of the greatest makeup people in the whole world, Mark Coulier, helping us with the exterior of these characters. It was interesting because in some ways, as an actor, you're like, well, it's a very impressive thing that everyone notices, but in some way, we had nothing to do with it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just inside of this thing that someone else created, this sculpture that someone else created. So the challenge for us was finding the inner life of these people and why they were the way they were. Why did they make those gestures? Why did they walk like that?
We were a little skeptical at first of the idea of prosthetic.
Sure, stuff like that. But
because we might think we don't want to turn this into something that's that gets in the way of the performance. And I was actually I don't want any makeup. Let's just try and get to the core of who these people were, you know, and forget about that stuff. And then we did a test, and I was like, oh, this is pretty good. I think then it was impressive. It was like, oh, I think we can work with this.
Yeah, the ball was in our court then. Like, well, we look like them. We better get to work with this act and this accent and this. Yeah, all of it.
Well, it's a hell of a lot easier than doing a De Niro and trying to put on, 100 or 200 pounds for a role, I guess.
Yeah, I don't even think De Niro put on that much.
Well,
A 100 is just not safe.
No.
Yeah.
Well, it's been so much fun. Before we go, I just have to ask, John, can you do Oliver Hardy's famous line for me?
There's some controversy about what that line actually was. Another nice mess you've gotten us
into. He famously never said, that's another fine mess you've got me into. One of the shows was called Another Fine Mess.
There we go.
And he said, that's another mess you've gotten me into. But he never said, it's another fine mess you've got me into. That's one for the anoraks.
You guys sound like the real thing.
Yeah. We've set the record straight on Kick-Ass News.
Well, once again, the movie is called Stan and Ollie in theaters December 28th. Steve Coogan and John C. Reilly, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Thanks again to John C. Reilly and Steve Coogan for coming on the podcast. Stan and Ollie opens in theaters in New York and Los Angeles this Friday, December 28th. For more information, visit sonyclassics.com/Stan and Ollie. When you need energy on the go and don't have time to wait in line, grab Espresso Monster. I had one today and it gave me just the shot in the arm I needed. Plus, it tastes so good, I'd drink it anyway. That's because Espresso Monster is a premium blend of espresso and cream made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend complete with taurine and B vitamins. Each can has 3 shots of espresso and comes in vanilla espresso or espresso and cream flavors. Close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.